Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on U.S. competitiveness in the world economy. In this first half hour, we'll hear from Fred Hochberg. He's chairman and president of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. He'll be in conversation with James Manyika, director of McKinsey's Global Institute. This event was recorded before a World Affairs audience in San Francisco and is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, James Manyika.
After decades of an expansive period of globalization that has brought many more nations into the global economy and trade has expanded and has also been credited with bringing more millions of people out of poverty than anything else, following the recession of 2008, this process is slowed down somewhat by some measures, the process of globalization. At the same time, we seem to be going through a period where public sentiment seems to have soured on globalization and trade. However, at the same time, there are a plethora of trade deals that are on the table around the world, some involving the United States, some not. And many of them have created a lot of emotion and energy with many people for them and some people against them. However, at the same time, most people agree that it is critical that America retains its competitive edge in the global economy when it comes to innovation, exports, as well as industries of the future. So all of this makes for a very confusing time and period for us. At least if nothing else, it makes for a very confusing political season. Well, at least to get a better understanding of all of this, we're very fortunate to have with us today Fred Hochberg. Fred Hochberg is the chairman and president of the Export and Import Bank of the United States. This role makes him one of the most, the highest ranking business leaders in the Obama administration. During his 7 years of leadership at the Exim Bank, Fred has supported more, and the Exim Bank have supported more than 1.4 million American jobs and financed exports with a value exceeding $240 billion, while generating more than $2 billion in surplus revenue for U.S. taxpayers. He has also focused on expanding America's global footprint of in key domestic industries in which United States exporters have a comparative advantage. These include renewable energy, aerospace technology, medical products, construction and farm machinery, as well as agriculture. In addition to that, and this is also a little bit part of his heritage, he has spent a fair amount of time focused on small business and small business exports and trying to encourage and finance their activities abroad. Before being at Exim Bank, Fred was in the private sector, but he'd also served for a brief period as acting administrator of the Small Business Administration in the Clinton administration. So we're very delighted to have Fred join us to have this conversation. Please welcome Fred Hochberg.
Let me tell you briefly what the Export-Import Bank does. We are the official export credit agency of the United States. We provide loans, guarantees, and insurance when U.S. companies are competing and selling abroad. This was actually started by FDR in 1934, to encourage companies to expand overseas, sell overseas, and support U.S. jobs, with an understanding that there was partly a fear of selling abroad and a perceived feel about selling abroad. So President Roosevelt said, well, if we have an export bank that will provide the financing that will bypass some of the banks or give banks the assurance, we can create more jobs here at home. So we've been doing that since 1934. We've been in business 82 years. And the fact is, we do export a lot of products and services. And in fact, it may come as a surprise, we are actually the second largest exporter in the entire world. We are only beaten by China, and yet a decade ago, we were the largest single exporting nation in the entire world. So it's not that long ago, a decade ago, I actually believe, and I hope we'll have a chance to talk about it, we could easily be the number one exporting nation again, partly what's happening here in California. This is home to many innovations and many products that are and services that are sought around the world. A company I visited down in Orange County called Firm Green started by a man I've gotten to know, Steve Wilburn, who's a Marine veteran. He came up with a service and a product that essentially converts methane gas from landfills, and I visited the largest landfill in Latin America outside of Rio, and turns into usable energy. We provided, because it was hard for him to get a loan, and in fact, when he bid on the, before he could bid on the project, he was told by the Brazilian authorities, well, you need, where's your ECA? And he said, I don't even know what that is. Where's your export credit agency? And he says, I don't know what that is. They said, well, you better go get, talk to them before you can, before we'll even look at your bid. So we provided a loan guarantee, financing, $48 million, 12 years, about 2.5%. And that enabled that project to come to be sold by an American company, created jobs in about 7 states. And that's basically the kind of work that we do. Also, while I was in California, I visited SpaceX. SpaceX is owned, as you know, by Elon Musk. We are in a competitive fight primarily with France and Russia, China to a less extent. Those are the, but France, Russia, and the United States are the three countries that both manufacture satellites and produce rocket launches. So we're in a very competitive situation. We make sure there's a level playing field when we're competing, when SpaceX is competing, or the satellite companies, Orbital, Loral, Boeing, and so Lockheed Martin, for example, to make sure that we can compete on a level playing field. This is a competitive market. We have been financing in the last several years as much as 60% of commercial satellite launches and satellites to make sure that we can compete effectively against two countries, particularly France and Russia, that have a very, I would say, statist view and a very protectionist view of making sure those industries flourish. So basically, we are the export credit agency supporting companies like SpaceX, Firm Green, and many other small businesses. There are about 85 export credit agencies around the world. A number are in the what's called the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that sets a framework so that we compete fairly with other countries, and there's a level playing field in terms of the competition. Now, we've got a lot of, there are a number of countries, more than half are not a member of the OECD, and that's causing some difficulty in the global framework on how we do that. One of the things that I've seen is when countries are looking to expand and grow and build their economy and put people to work, there are less and less levers to pull. We look at things like fiscal stimulus. President Obama put in a fiscal stimulus package within 2 months of taking office, a very contentious fight. It was $800 billion. There are those, including those in the White House, who wanted more, but that was the most we could get. It was a very contentious battle, as you may recall. It is very hard to add fiscal stimulus. Many countries either have too much debt or perceive too much debt, so that becomes a difficult vehicle to expand economies. Monetary policy, we're at near zero. Europe is at negative interest rates. There's not a lot left that central banks can do to boost the economy. So more and more countries are looking at exports, are looking at expanding exports, and particularly look at an export credit agency as a tool, because one, exports create jobs, it's very visible, and by the WTO, we all have to be self-sustaining, so as a result, it doesn't cost money for legislators and government. So it's a very appealing thing, but it has made the competitive landscape much more challenging for us. We, for example, do make a profit each year, and I will just close with this. We collect revenue, as I mentioned, fees on our interest on loans, or like points on a mortgage. We collect insurance premiums, we do credit insurance. So we take revenue, we put aside a loan loss reserve account in case we have a write-off. Congress allows us to retain about $100 million from what we generate, and the rest we send to you, the taxpayers. Now, in most, where I was in business, sales minus cost equals profit. Guess what? We don't have the word profit in the federal budget. It doesn't exist. The word they use is negative subsidy. Now, it's like when you go to the doctor and the doctor says, looks at the report and the doctor says everything is negative, and you realize that's a good thing. So negative subsidy is a good thing. I will tell you, it took me at least 6 months on the job to be really comfortable that something with the word negative and subsidy was a positive. So we generate a negative subsidy. We just recently sent $284 million to the Treasury in cash. It's a very sad day for our chief financial officer. But it does, it's further evidence that we actually do, we are self-sustaining, do make a profit, and our job is to help keep American companies competitive, and most importantly, American workers competitive, so we support more good-paying jobs in America. So with that, let me join James, and we'll have a conversation.
Well, thank you, Fred. But before we dive into a bunch of topics we're going to explore, I want you to maybe fill out a part of what you do which you didn't quite fill out. So it is the Export and Import Bank. So you made a case for the export part. Talk a little bit about the import part of it. Why does that matter? Why do you do it?
Well, two reasons. Actually, a former chairman had the idea that we should change our name to the U.S. Export Bank. Then our name would be USEX, and we have enough challenge with Congress and our senators without introducing the word sex into our name. So that's one reason.
Okay.
A second reason is, in the very early days, in the 30s, we would export capital equipment, and we would sometimes finance the import of the products from that capital equipment as a way of, as a development tool, and also as a way of helping those countries pay off that capital equipment. But today, frankly, imports get into our country. They do not need my help whatsoever, so we are purely export-driven. Our name is just an historical name.
Okay. So it's good to clarify that.
And I don't want to include sex in anything we do.
It's a good thing. The theme for this session is protecting America's competitive advantage. You made the point that for a very long time, America was the world's largest exporter. Now China is the world's largest exporter. Talk a little bit about what you mean when you say, when you think about America's competitive advantage. Should it just be measured in terms of exports, or are there other measures you'd think about in this global economy?
Well, there are a number of metrics. I mean, I think in terms of, we're one of the least reliant countries on trade and exports. I mean, if for one day global trade came to a total and complete stop, we would be probably less impacted than any other country. We'd certainly be impacted, but it's a less of an impact. So what I'm talking about is, when I looked at it, it's not that long ago that we were the largest exporter. Exports are a larger portion of our economy today than at any other time. We think of the 1950s as being sort of the heyday of manufacturing. Exports were about 5% of GDP. It's been hovering in the 12, 13, as high as 14%, depending on what time of year. So when I look around, and particularly on this visit, I've been on the West Coast for the week, the innovations, the kind of far-reaching thinking about products, technology, renewable energy, electric vehicles, aerospace, entertainment, we have all the ingredients and a good rule of law. Our infrastructure could be better, but it is still better than many places. We have an educated workforce. We have a lot of advantages that I think can propel us. I think about it, it's a little bit like diet and exercise. You know, if I only diet, it's hard to lose weight. If I only exercise, it's hard to lose. If you do both, it works. So if we can produce more, export more, maybe we import a little bit less, a lot of things come into alignment very quickly. Balance of payment, more people working. There are a lot of things that will fall into line. So I'm a little more, perhaps in my narrowed focus on my job, I'm a little more focused on exports. And since I took this job, I only buy American wines, mostly California wines.
Well, you mentioned wines. You've clearly picked a few sectors that you've chosen to focus on. And we talked about some of them, so renewables and aerospace and so forth. Why those sectors? Is it because those sectors you think need the most help, or the ones that are most under threat? Why those sectors?
Sure. Well, probably what I should have talked about is 90% of the customers we work with, 90% are small businesses, and small business defined by the SBA. So that still makes up the bulk of the transactions, right, are small businesses. We have, and actually, full disclosure, McKinsey actually did a strategic plan for the bank when I started, and we identified a number of key markets that had infrastructure needs, growing rapidly, and had limited access to capital. And we looked at a number of locations, and we said, what product categories, mostly for on larger scale, large capital goods that need 10, 12, or renewable energy or nuclear power, 18-year financing, that are difficult to obtain in the private sector. So what I found, interestingly, is we identified 9 countries, and after 2 or 3 years, those countries actually underperformed the portfolio. But what was outperforming the portfolios were certain sectors. So what the world needs, and particularly emerging economies, we don't call them developing anymore, we have to call them emerging, it's a better term, they need power, and they need infrastructure. So a lot of it has to do with power that's in demand, that we have a competitive advantage. In terms of transportation, everything from locomotives to helicopters to crop dusters, agricultural aircraft to commercial aircraft, we have a huge competitive advantage. Right. So we have we go where the money is. Where is there a need? Who comes to us and seeks our financing in order to close a sale? That's really determines what we go to.
So you're demand-driven.
We're all demand-driven. We have not picked one industry over another. We go, those who need us come. One of the reasons I've spent the week out here was there's a large demand for renewable energy and environmentally beneficial power, and we have not been doing as much as the demand I keep hearing from Argentina, Colombia, Sri Lanka, India, Bangladesh. So I met with, goodness, probably 24 or more companies in the last 4 or 5 days to make sure they understand what we can do and what are their business needs to make sure our financial products keep them competitive.
Well, it's actually good to hear you explain that, because one of the criticisms, as you know, that's often levied on Exim is the fact that you're enacting industrial policy by picking winners and losers. But I think here you talk about the fact that you're demand-driven is actually very important. The other critique you typically also hear is that you're there to help large businesses. But it sounds like, at least with your focus on small and medium-sized businesses, that's not the case.
You know, that's why we've made the point that 90% of our customers are small business. And when I say small business, again, it's defined by our Small Business Administration. It's not our own little private, handcrafted, artisanal definition.
Right.
It's the universal definition the U.S. government uses.
Right. So given that, I mean, take us through, because, you know, Exim went through a pretty extraordinary process over the last year of getting reauthorization and so forth. Why is it that, given the statistics you just gave about impact on jobs, impact on exports, you shipped money to the Treasury the other day, and you're supporting small and medium-sized businesses, and you're demand-driven. So what's the issue?
I get this question all the time. particularly from small businesses that find it mystifying. You guys, you create jobs, you send money, you make a profit, and if without you, my bank would not make the loan. I think that, let's remember one thing. Although we had a lapse of 5 months and 4 days, and I was counting, we had an overwhelming majority. In the House of Representatives, a majority of the Republicans voted for the Ex-Im Bank, every Democrat except for one. In the Senate, we had a 2/3 majority, every Democrat except for one, who was at one point running for president, was with the bank. So we had an overwhelming majority. However, there was a small minority that had an ideological view that there isn't a role for this, and a lot of them were in leadership. So we had the leader, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, and the chairman of the Banking Committee were not pro-Ex-Im. We had a number of people in House leadership and Senate leadership that were not pro-Ex-Im. And if you think about if the chairman of a company or the chairman of a board or a nonprofit doesn't want to do something, it was a challenge to work through that. But we had, again, an overwhelming majority. The vote last year was right around Halloween, and so we got 313 votes in the House, so the jack-o'-lanterns in front of our house were carved with 313. So I should make that my password. So it wasn't overwhelming, but we did face a real challenge. Part of the other challenge was We're one of the very few sunset agencies, and we were sunset in our ability to do new loans. So we became an easy target for those who want to show some limitation of government, because if they don't approve us, we had to stop making new loans. We still had to service our portfolio, but we were prevented from doing anything new.
So Fred, you know, we find ourselves in a very unusual place when it comes to trade and globalization. On the one hand, you know, most economists will say trade is good. You know, globalization is a net good overall. Yet at the same time, on the other hand, our current politics say it's not. What's the disconnect? What's underlying that?
Well, I think partly some of it gets, I think, caught up in immigration policy. And I think that these things are not always that discrete in terms of how people make decisions and how they craft their views. I was reading just the other day something like 70% of people do not know what TPP is.
Yes.
So I think that there's a lot of misinformation. And I will address particularly the business leaders in this room. I think the business community has done a poor job.
Of explaining?
And I will, because the business community is keenly focused on taxes and regulation, and when they're done with that, they want to talk about regulation and taxes, and then at the end of the day, we'd like to talk about taxes and regulation. Now, many, many companies benefit enormously from trade and exports, and exports in particular. It is one thing for the CEO and the head of government affairs to go speak to a member of Congress. It's another thing to make sure their employees are engaged. I was in this small electronics factory in Jackson, Mississippi, and 80 people, and in the lunchroom were about 75 or 80 foreign flags. And it was to remind every employee, that's where our sales go. And the week I was there, something like 35% of the production was going to Saudi Arabia. And everybody there knows that. And so they're engaged in trade. They understand that's why they have a good paycheck. So I think the business community could do a far better job of including their workforce in those benefits, so it is not seen as a sort of elite versus working class issue. And our mandate at the Export and Import Bank is purely supporting US jobs. You know, my example is when GE manufactures in the United States and they need financing to sell, we'll back them. If they're going to manufacture in France, that's all very fine and good, but go talk to the French. We do not provide any support whatsoever. It's only about what's done here.
But I would imagine that presumably part of the pushback we're seeing comes from particular communities or particular industries, whether it's textiles and others, that have been adversely impacted by, at least when it comes to jobs, by globalization.
And actually, in our last reorganization, Congress mandated we put a textile representative on our advisory committee. And I've spent some time in Greensboro, and we actually can be competitive. We're not going to be competitive on cut and sew work. We are very competitive on converting cotton into yarn. And we do a lot of exporting to Asia and to Central America, where it's woven into socks, T-shirts, and so forth. So we have to think about where we have a competitive advantage, which is in innovation, in automated manufacturing. I was in a Caterpillar locomotive plant in Muncie, Indiana, 750,000 square feet, 315 employees. When you walk in, it looks like it's perpetually on lunch break because there's so few people. But we have automated that. We are actually, one of the things that we're actually manufacturing more, but there are less people engaged in it because we are, and that's how we keep our competitive advantage. If we were becoming less and less efficient, we would soon be out of business. But the fact is, we do have a competitive advantage. We have to just focus on those areas.
Right. Now, I mean, you obviously raised the point that maybe as we get more competitive and more productive, we're employing fewer and fewer people. Maybe that's part of the pushback on...
That's part of it, but I think we're also... you introduced me to a company called Flextronics. We're going to be... I think more manufacturing is beginning to reshore, because if you can automate and you actually... And there's not that large a labor component to the finished product, there's less and less reason why you'd want to produce something 8,000 miles away and spend 45 days getting it here when you can produce it here and get to market within 24 or 48 hours.
Right, right.
So, I mean, Nike is an example. You'll be able to go online, pick the color, the style, the shape, and you may be able to get it delivered in 48 hours. Well, that needs localized manufacturing. There may be less people involved initially, but we have to bring more companies here. One of the things Secretary Pritzker is championing with President Obama is Select USA. We got to get more companies manufacturing in our country. That's how we're going to also support more jobs. And they manufacture here, and then they're going to export from here. And that's a real benefit we haven't really capitalized on until recently.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's actually one of the more remarkable achievements, which is between Select USA and Invest USA, U.S. has actually seen a resurgence of foreign direct investment
exactly.
back into the United States. Given that this session is largely about U.S.'s competitive advantage, we've both made the point that there's all these trade deals on the table, and you've made the comment that we run the risk of sitting on the sidelines when everybody else is setting up trade deals if we keep pushing back on the current trade. Say more about what you mean by sitting on the sidelines.
Well, partly trade became a four-letter word, number one. Two, when the first trade deals we did, NAFTA and so forth, were done in the mid-90s, there were maybe a dozen trade deals globally. Today, there are over 600. So whether we like it or not, the world is creating free trade deals all the time. And China, for example, has formed their own somewhat version of like a Trans-Pacific Partnership called RECEP, the Regional Cooperative Economic
Program,
which essentially is stitching together a lot of the countries in Asia and Southeast Asia. So we have a choice. We're going to be, if we don't do a trade deal, we're going to be on the sidelines, and people are going to be trading freely amongst each other, and we will be boxed out of those markets. Before we had a trade deal with Colombia, I was down there. They were buying wheat from Argentina. They preferred wheat from North Dakota, but until we had a free trade agreement, it was too expensive. And with a free trade agreement, that began to change again. So whether we like it or not, that's what's happening in the world, and we have to decide we're either going to find a way to do it well and make sure we protect workers and protect people who are disenfranchised or losing their job. But if we think we can just sit this out, we cannot.
One of the questions that's come through is, because you're in California, in the Bay Area, is what do you see the impact of technology and digitization in what you do and the kinds of small and medium-sized businesses that you support?
Well, I think what I'm seeing mostly is that we are highly competitive. When companies are selling in the market, and particularly the goods we're selling, which are higher technology goods, higher value-added goods, What America offers is looking at the total lifetime cost of a product, not simply the acquisition cost. We make, as I said, locomotives. We're getting to a point where we're producing driverless trains that are being used in mining areas in Australia because the trains run 24/7. And if otherwise you've got to somehow helicopter someone to the middle of the desert every 8 or 12 hours to start shifting. So now they're driverless trains. So that gives us a competitive advantage. And we can that train can be monitored remotely. We have driverless trucks that are being used in mining situations, also American-made from Caterpillar. So this automation is giving us that competitive advantage that we're not gonna sell market goods. I was down in Monterey Airport. The conveyor belts for luggage leading up to the baggage screening areas were made in Mexico. The baggage screening equipment that, in terms of protecting people for security, was American made. So those products we have to just keep ahead, and we have a good competitive environment. We have a lot of innovation. We actually celebrate entrepreneurship in this country. So I'm very bullish about that, but it means we have to keep moving and we have to keep changing. We have to keep ahead of the competition, because the competition, and I would say particularly places like China, South Korea, Japan are moving, particularly China and South Korea, moving up the value chain very rapidly. So China's producing an airplane to compete with the Boeing aircraft and Airbus. So if we don't move quickly, they're going to come after us.
So in closing, I mean, you may have seen one of the things that's gone viral recently is the note that President Bush left for President Clinton when he came into office. If you were to write a note for the next chairman of the bank, what would you tell them?
Well, I would do everything possible to not have our charter expire every 3 to 5 years, because that puts American companies in a real competitive disadvantage and too much uncertainty. We have a board of 5 people that approve larger transactions. There are only 2. We lack a quorum, so we need to find a way that the next chairman can make sure that we can continue to operate and not have this start and stop. Because business, I was in business for 20 years. You are not planning a week or two at a time. You're planning a year, 2 and 3 years at a time. And we need to make sure we give that assurance. And the third thing is, I think that we need to be focused on what we do well. And when we look at competitiveness, as we're talking about here, it's trade deals, it's infrastructure, it's education, it's thinking about our tax system, all of those things. And certainly, we have an election in a few weeks. We're gonna be looking at that in a new administration, how we address those issues, because that will impact the kind of lives we live, the kind of lives our children and families live, in terms of having a good livelihood and a great standard of living in this country.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We just heard from Fred Hochberg. He's chairman and president of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. And he was in conversation with James Manyika, director of McKinsey's Global Institute. Next, we'll hear from Rana Faruhar, assistant managing editor of Time. She's in conversation about sustainable economic growth with Tim O'Reilly, founder of O'Reilly Media. This conversation took place before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Tim O'Reilly.
Let's unpack this a little bit for people who haven't read your book. So let's talk a little bit about your fundamental notion of how financialization has changed the shape of business. And actually, let's start where you start your book. It opens with a fairly blistering indictment of Apple under Tim Cook.
Yeah.
And because we think of Apple as this great innovative company, to have them play a starring role in a book about what's gone wrong is perhaps,
a little edgy.
So maybe talk a little bit. What's your beef there?
Yeah, what's your problem with that? It's funny, my editor said that too. You sure you want to start with America's most loved company? And I'm like, yeah, you know, why not? The reason I actually started with Apple, I got interested in Apple because I'd actually done a profile for Time a few years ago on Carl Icahn, the big corporate raider / activist investor. That's a rebranding, which I get into a little bit in the book as well. And he was, until quite recently, holding a fair bit of Apple stock. And he was tweeting every few weeks, telling Tim Cook, telling the board of Apple to do more share buybacks, which many of you probably know, when companies do share buybacks, it artificially decreases the number of shares on the market, and it generally has the effect of bolstering the share price, but it doesn't actually really change anything in the underlying corporate story. And it's interesting because not just Apple, but many American companies historically tend to do share buybacks at the very top of the market. So when a stock has risen, when growth has happened, and the company is at a turning point, and they don't really have anything else in terms of their growth story to sell to the public or to sell to Wall Street, share buybacks are a good way to keep getting a little bit more stock price hit. The problem is that Apple was issuing debt to do these share buybacks. And that in itself is a little bit ironic, because you look at Apple, it's one of the richest, if not the richest, companies in the world right now. They've got about $200 billion worth of cash sitting in bank accounts, many of them overseas in tax havens, because they don't want to bring back the money to the U.S. and pay the higher than average U.S. corporate tax rate on it. We could go off on a tangent about whether that's really fair, given that so much of what makes the iPhone smart was actually developed by the federal government, but I'll leave that for another question or another panel. But it was a deep irony to me that here's this company that doesn't need any capital and yet is more involved in the capital markets than ever before. So over the last few years, Apple has made promises to give back to investors in the form of share buyback and dividends, almost as much as it has sitting in bank accounts abroad. And that's because it can do these very low interest bond offerings. It's very cheap right now to do that in the U.S. Well, why is it so cheap? because we had a financial crisis in 2008, and because we had no real fiscal policy, and politicians were gridlocked and unable to come up with a real way to bolster the Main Street economy, the Fed, the central bank, parachuted in, dumped a lot of money in the economy, kept rates very, very low, so corporations can now take on a lot of debt. So this is a long-winded way to say you've got the richest company in the world holding more debt than ever before, paying out the wealthiest 10% of the population, which owns about 80% of the stock, rather than investing, as I think, you know, Steve Jobs might have done, in the new thing, you know, in the big R&D investment, in the blue sky invention that's really going to change the economy. And that, to me, is a very Kafkaesque system and a good place to start exploring this trend of financialization.
Right. Well, there's another aspect to that, which is, of course, that the Apple devices are made in low-wage countries as opposed to being made here, with the argument that you have to do that in order to, you know, be competitive. And yet, here's Apple, you know, the most profitable company in the world, saying, well, if we don't use low-wage employers, if we actually did this in America, you know, we wouldn't be competitive. You know, you're starting to dissect sort of the scene of a problem here, which is that corporate profit is made sacrosanct above all else.
Yes.
And that goes back to something that law professor Lynn Stout has called the shareholder value myth. You know, if you scratch any business person, they'll basically repeat this idea that corporate boards and executives have a fiduciary duty. Their primary duty is to enrich their shareholders. Turns out that there's very little legal support for that, and that boards and company officials have wide discretion to pursue social goals and to do other things, you know, long-term strategy, and yet this doesn't happen. And and really, that's a lot of what you talk about in your book. Why? Why?
Yeah.
Can you kind of tell us, why is it that people have kind of bought into this?
So Lynn Stout is amazing. She's a professor at Cornell, and she actually did a big interview for the book and has some great stuff to say on this. Chapter 4 of my book looks at, chapter 3 and 4 actually look at this issue. And this myth of shareholder value was part and parcel of what's called the Chicago School of Economic Thinking. It was a sort of a markets know best, just focus on the share price and everything else will sort of follow, social good will follow from that kind of thinking. I'm generalizing a little bit, but that's basically where corporate America was over the last 40 years. And, you know, it's not like there was one change point. We've had a number of decades of small legislative, legal, regulatory changes that have created a system of incentives which now pushes any public corporation in these very, I think, short-term directions towards outsourcing, towards job displacement, towards financial engineering rather than the real kind. And, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is I've been a business and economic journalist for 24 years now, and I would meet these really smart CEOs and many times really good people. You know, they were doing philanthropy and they were involved in their communities, and, you know, I recognized them to be really good people, but they'd be making these terrible short-term business decisions that were basically all about maximizing share price and, you know, oftentimes were devaluing everything else. We're devaluing their own workers. We're not necessarily making decisions that were right for their customer base even, and so we're eroding the long-term potential market share of the company. And it was all down to shareholder value. And then I also had the perspective of having lived and worked abroad and seen some of the models in Europe, I knew that this was not the only way to do things. So I think for until quite recently, I mean, this is a very nascent conversation still, people just thought this is how capitalism works. Shareholder capitalism is, that's what you do. But it's not what they do in Germany. For example, there's a model of stakeholder capitalism that's much more based around local ecosystems in which workers have a seat at the table, civic society and government officials have a seat at the table. There's a shared conversation which, as I explained in my book, can really actually help corporations. Well, one of the examples I get into is after the financial crisis, the U.S. manufacturing sector laid off a huge number of workers. immediately. And the Germans did this a little differently. A lot of the German manufacturing companies in the Mittelstand near Stuttgart had a different model. They went, put workers on furloughs, used the extra time to do retraining, upgrading in factories, basically pushing forward their own processes and upgrading them when there wasn't a lot of work to be had, so that by the time the global economy started to recover in 2010 and China was coming back, the Germans were ready to go. They were all up and running, and they grabbed a lot of market share from American companies who had taken this much more short-term, we're just going to cut we want to cut our capital costs, we want to marshal our capital at the expense of all else. And that turned out to be a very bad decision in the long run.
So let's bring this back around to Brexit. Mm. Because, of course, part of what the Brits were saying, at least the 50% of the Brits who voted for, or 50% of those who voted, keep that in mind, that we don't have enough people voting on these important issues.
Gosh, yes. Yeah.
But of this large, you know, poll, effectively, 50% slight majority said we want out from under this European model because we actually don't, you know, believe that the benefits of that model have been sufficient. And there's a couple of things there. One is the role of government perhaps over-regulating. But there's also really a real distrust of globalization.
Yes.
And, you know, globalization is another piece of this story. And I'm really always of two minds about globalization because there is this very powerful narrative about companies using the cheapest labor they can find anywhere, and if they can't find cheap labor, they're going to outsource to machines. And this narrative, you know, effectively people are a cost to be disposed of whenever possible. And that's clearly driving this populism. And yet there's another side of globalism, which I see pointedly in Max Roser's tweets, Our World in Data, if you ever seen his wonderful series of visualizations out of Oxford. You know, they're basically changes in, you know, world health or world poverty over time. And globalization clearly has brought up large segments of the world. And at the same time, it has actually depressed, you know, the incomes of many former people in middle incomes. And so it looks like we have a zero-sum game. You know, some people are getting worse so that others can get better. And yet, I think the story is more complex than that. And what you've brought to it with this notion of, well, how much is going to corporate profits versus how much is going to workers is another piece of that narrative.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how do we tell the story correctly so that we make the right economic prescriptions for our society?
So it's such a great question, and it's such a complicated topic. I mean, the thing that comes to mind is I had a conversation once with Howard Schultz, who is one of the, interestingly, founder leaders. It tends to be founders, I think, that think more about this or perhaps have more leeway within the context of their own companies to pursue goals beyond just share price. But we had a conversation about this very topic, and he kind of summed it in an interesting and pithy way. He said, look, we're becoming a nation of latte makers and latte buyers. And I have to make sure that there's more latte buyers because otherwise the math starts to not work. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and what he's saying is that in a economy like ours, and which is similar to most advanced economies, where consumer spending makes up 70% of what happens, when people haven't gotten a raise in real terms since the early 1990s, and many working people, aka the Trump voters, you know, particularly laid off white men in the Rust Belt, haven't gotten a raise in real terms since the 70s, you've got a problem, not just economically, but politically, as we're seeing now. So to me, a lot of this is about thinking about the wage share, how to get the wage share up, because over the last 40 years, that's what's so marked is you see, if you divide the economic pie up into the public sector, the corporate sector, and labor, labor's share just keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. The corporate sector keeps getting bigger and bigger because of globalization.
But not just because of globalization, because of choices that companies make, which is partly the short-term profit maximization.
That's true, and that's right. I'm glad that you rephrased that for me. It's globalization is one of the things that enables capital to flow where it wants to, which tends to be where it's cheapest. You're talking about outsourcing to low-wage countries. What I think is that we're at a tipping point with that for a variety of reasons. For starters, a lot of those low-wage countries like China are starting to have their own problems with jobs leaving their country. A lot of Chinese jobs, factory jobs, are now going to lower-wage Asian countries. There's a sort of whole reevaluation of supply chains going on that I think will bring all this into question. But to me, it's what policies are going to increase the wage share in a way that's sustainable and also support local ecosystems. I think that's where the action is.
Yeah, I think this image of latte buyers and latte makers is fairly central, and to the short-term thinking. Effectively, when you take money and it goes to Carl Icahn, it comes out of the real economy.
Right.
My friend Nick Hanauer, who's a wealthy venture capitalist, was one of the early investors in Amazon, says, I'm a rich guy, but I'm really clear that capital doesn't create jobs. Only customers create jobs.
Right.
And he said, if we don't pay people enough, they can't be our customers, and we're all going to suffer. He said, I can only sleep in one bed. I can only use one pillow. I can't, I can take a certain number of vacations, more than an ordinary person, but I can't take, a million times as many as an ordinary person. And so there's this circular economy, which is sort of part of the self-interest. Mm-hmm. Part of what you're really putting your finger on is we've written the rules. And I love, by the way, a book I highly recommend for everyone is Joe Stiglitz's Rewriting the Rules. Mm-hmm. Because he's the, Nobel Prize winning economist who's really put his finger on this notion that our economy is not like the law of gravity. There are economic laws, perhaps, but there's an awful lot of it that is tilted by the rules that we've written for the economy. Mm. And those rules currently favor certain kinds of financial interests over, for example, labor, the incentive structure for corporate CEOs. So maybe could you talk a little bit about the trade-offs that we make when we sort of reward financialization over productive investment, when we reward financialization over, hiring people who can also be customers? These are some of the kinds of trade-offs you talk about in your book.
Yeah, for sure. So Stiglitz's book is amazing, and this plan that he's developed, which was supported by the Roosevelt Institute, is a big part of the sort of backbone of my book. I get into some of the suggestions and the pivot points he talks about. One of the things that strikes me, and I have a whole chapter on this, is the way in which our tax code incentivizes behaviors that are not necessarily growing the Main Street economy. So, for example, the tax code subsidizes debt in many ways, in ways that are not necessarily productive at both the consumer level and at the corporate level. So, one example that I think most of us are familiar with is the mortgage interest tax deduction, which I'm a huge beneficiary of. I live in a townhouse in Brooklyn and, get to write a lot of that off my taxes. But what's interesting is when you look at who's benefiting, it's largely the middle and the upper classes from the vast bulk of the mortgage interest tax deduction. And it also has this other perverse effect of pushing up asset prices, because I can tell you housing prices would not be what they are in my neighborhood and probably in San Francisco if people weren't able to write all that debt off their taxes. So then that has the effect of making it harder for younger people to get into the housing market, for example, which is still where the majority of Americans keep the majority of their wealth, and so on and so forth. Same is true at the corporate level. Much, much easier to write off debt from your taxes than it is to say, do something productive with your capital and then be rewarded in some way or incentivized for that investment. So that's one example. I could go on if you liked.
Yeah, it does bring up the whole question of, who are the members of the financial class? Certainly, historically, the argument has been, well, this is, the pensions of teachers and, firefighters and, you look at that. But the pressures that lead to the short-term thinking are not actually driven necessarily by those people. You talk a little bit about Jack Bogle and what's happened with Vanguard and index funds, and they don't have the same pressure that a managed fund has to outperform the market, because they say, no, we are the market. And so if you are an active fund, you're subject to the same kind of pressures of Carl Icahn, where you're trying to actually maximize your short-term profit this quarter so that you'll get more investors, et cetera, et cetera. So the mutual fund industry is actually fighting in some ways, with the exception of the index funds, really fighting against the interests of its small shareholders.
Yes.
And not to mention that, also charging extensive fees.
Right.
Talk about Jack Bogle a little bit.
So Jack Bogle is awesome. So he is the founder of Vanguard, and he was one of my primary sources on the book. And as Tim and I were talking about earlier, one of the things that was fascinating to me is when I was speaking to folks in the financial industry to do interviews for this book, many of the bankers and the financiers that spoke to me and were interested and agreed with the thesis in the book tended to be older, in their 70s or even 80s, and they had seen the way the industry had changed. So they had seen a time when financiers were stewards of people's money, you know, and banks were basically, you know, and asset managers took people's money, banks took it, held it in the form of deposits, and then lent it out to business. That's kind of what Adam Smith imagined that capitalism should do. I'm going to go astray and then come back to asset managers. The killer stat in my book, by the way, I think is based on some deep academic research that over the last 40 years, that model has entirely changed. So only 15% of the money being held in U.S. institutions now goes to business investment. So the rest of it is existing in this closed loop of trading, of bidding up of existing assets, all of which creates the kind of bubbles that we've seen pop over the last decade and makes it difficult to have a sustainable, non-volatile economy. So let me come back to Jack Bogle. So Bogle started Vanguard Funds and, you know, like anybody who's in the asset management industry, saw very quickly that hardly any actively managed funds ever outperform the market. It's just, you know, once in a blue moon does it happen. And yet, because most of us are in 401ks, many of us are in actively managed funds that are pushed by the companies that we work for, who are sold those products by these big asset managers. Asset management, by the way, is the fastest growing part of the financial industry. So we spend a lot of time in this country talking about too big to fail banks, but the action is actually in asset management. That's where a lot of financial business is going. It's where the largest pool of money is. So Bogle, who's a big believer in, you know, you put your money in an index fund and you forget about it until you're 65 or 70 or whenever you need it, started crunching some numbers on all this and found that for the average person who has their retirement egg in an actively managed set of funds, pays those higher than average fees, and then deals with the lower than average returns, that will eat up between 30 to 60% of your nest egg over your lifetime. So it is really a scandal, I think, and it's something that policymakers are starting to talk about. We're starting to see push, as is here in California, for state-run plans where folks that don't have access to investment vehicles can be put into no-load index funds and so on and so forth. There's also an argument to be made that, you know, Social Security should be strengthened. It's working. The private retirement system via actively managed funds is not working so well for most people. And I'll just make one more statement, which is that what's interesting is, as with so many aspects of the rise of finance, it's as though the head of the snake is beginning to eat the tail. Asset managers themselves and pension fund managers are starting to become panicked because they know we're entering a period of lower than average returns. In my mind, that's because we've had a very financialized kind of growth, a faux growth over the last 40 years as opposed to real growth. And so returns are going to be lower than were expected and were promised to many retirees. Retirees were made promises of 8% returns. They're going to be lucky to get 4. And there's going to be a real political backlash against all that.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting because there was a real opportunity with low rates. I still remember hearing a Larry Summers rant, right, when he was talking about the crumbling state of our infrastructure and saying, you know, if there was ever a time to invest in public infrastructure, this is right after, you know, 2008. He said, we have all these people out of work. You know, we have zero interest rates, effectively. Why would you not do all this work now? And instead, we took those low interest rates and used them simply to reinflate the bubble of the trading economy, which, as you point out, has supplanted real investment. You know, the original role of the financial sector was to support the real economy.
Yeah.
And instead, it's become this bubble economy where basically there's a giant casino where there's more money to be made simply, you know, betting or skimming the spread
Yes.
In the financial markets rather than reinvesting in a real business.
Yeah, for sure.
So what do we do about this? I mean, what are some of the concrete recommendations that you would make?
Yeah, bleak enough for you yet? We're gonna move into the solutions portion now. I have a solutions chapter in my book, but there's a broad array of conversations going on. I mean, you're leading some of them. I would start, and I do start in my book with, I think that we need to, the first thing we need to do is to change the narrative. There is still a narrative in East Coast policymaking circles, in Washington, in the Treasury Department, certainly on Wall Street, that the financial markets are the center of everything, that they really are the most important aspect of the economy, and it's the sort of got to save the banks to save the real economy sort of argument. Well, I would flip it and say the financial markets, financial services, and I stress the word services, are meant to serve other industries. And one of the things I do in my book is to try and lay out all the tension points that exist now between finance and real businesses, because what's happened is that not only has the financial sector changed its business model in such a way that it's no longer supporting actual industry, in many cases, it's competing with industry. So if I can speak for just a moment, one of the chapters in my book, I believe it's chapter 6, is on commodities prices and how volatile they've become because banks have gotten into the business of owning actual physical commodities. So, for example, that used to be illegal for Goldman Sachs to own half of the world's aluminum. As they recently did. You guys might have read the wonderful front page New York Times story from about 3 years ago. Goldman had cornered the world's aluminum market, and there are rules that are out there to prevent people from hoarding materials that, you know, we need for basic businesses to create products and machines, and in the case of wheat or rice or grain, to actually, you know, feed ourselves. There are rules that say you have to move those products in and out of warehouses every so often, and that's supposed to help us get around hoarding. Well, Goldman was moving the aluminum. It was just putting it on a forklift and moving it from one side of this room to the other and getting around the rules that way. And so they were cornering the market, and this had an impact on the real economy. For starters, it drove up the price of aluminum wildly, which hurts Coke, it hurts Coors, it hurts anybody that has to make aluminum cans. It also means that you were paying more in those 2 years for your six-pack and your drinks. That's a fairly mild example of how this can play out. I had a conversation from my book with a woman named Josette Chiron, who used to run the World Food Program. And she used to go around to places like Davos, you know, where the big muckety-mucks hang out and talk about this stuff. And she had a little red cup that she would take with her. And that cup held a day's worth of grain that would be delivered via the World Food Program to hungry children. And she would stand in front of people and she would say, this was right around 2009, 2010, when commodities prices had spiked. And she would say, this is how much grain I can give each child around the world every day. And then she would pour out half of it. That's how much I can give them now, because the cost of wheat and rice and, you know, all other kinds of foodstuffs has gone up so much. And it's gone up because traders, which now represent 30% of the commodities markets, are driving those food prices up. So that's just a very visceral example of how you have a financial system that isn't just, it's not just not lending, it's actively not supporting and degrading real business and society. And so we've got to change those things.
Well, thank you very, very much, Rana.
Thanks,
and I
Jim.
Hope everyone else enjoyed this as much as I have.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. The first segment of this program featured Fred Hochberg. He's chairman and president of the Export-Import Bank of the United States, and he was in conversation with James Manyika, director of the McKinsey Global Institute. In the second segment of our program, we heard from Rana Faruhar, assistant managing editor of Time magazine. She was in conversation with Tim O'Reilly, founder of O'Reilly Media. Visit us at worldaffairs.org to share this episode, to register for upcoming events, or to join the World Affairs Council. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.